Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
And they were all staring at me, and I said, "What's up?" And they go, "Did you hear? Kurt Cobain is dead." And he committed suicide that same day that I met Shirley. And it's very strange because obviously Nirvana was a huge, had a huge impact on my life. It allowed me to sort of pick and choose what I wanted to work on as a producer. But that's the day I met Shirley. So it's literally a changing of the guard. My path just went in a different path that day.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Hey, big Curious Creatures, welcome. None other than Mr. Butch Vig. Butch, welcome to the show.
Oh, Budgie, that is a very classy drum roll there. You totally nailed it.
Yeah.
I've been working on it.
Good.
Yeah. I love both of you as drummers. You both have totally unique personalities, and you've played on some incredible records that I listened to a billion times, you know, when I was a up-and-coming drummer, and even today. I'm really happy to be here with you today because I have much respect for both of you.
Well, thank you very much.
It's mutual respect, Butch. It's mutual. And by the way, we realize now, we know the mistake, the error of our ways, that actually the correct pronunciation is Butch. Yes. we got this from Shirley told us that. Yeah,
that's right. Shirley told us. She said, "You're saying it wrong. It's Butch.
It's Butch."
People get my name wrong. They call me Mitch, Bruce, Mitch. George. I don't know why I get called George, but I'll say, "Yeah, my name's Butch," and then they call me George like a minute later. So I guess there's something in that matches up somehow.
So we're all drummers here. We have a saying on the show, you know, all drummers are friends, right?
Yeah.
We're a clan,
yeah. Like goalkeepers, you know.
We just heard, what did we just hear that? All musicians are drummers, right? All vocalists are drummers.
Oh, yes. Wasn't that, oh my gosh, James Brown said that, right? He said that all musicians are
James
drummers.
James Brown said it, yes.
You know, I was very good friends with James' drummer, Clyde Stubblefield. He lived in Madison, and he used to play like three or four nights a week. He had like a Monday blues jam at this one club, and Tuesday was a funk jam out at like the Holiday Inn or whatever. He just loved to play. The coolest, nicest guy. He did not like working for James Brown.
Oh.
James is one of those guys who, if Clyde was an amazing drummer, he missed one little pickup, he'd go, "That's a $50 fine," you know. He would fine everybody. James was good. He knew if someone missed even a tiny grace note.
Wow.
But I mean, they made incredible music together. And I mean, James Brown was incredibly groundbreaking as an artist, especially, you know, how difficult it is to be African-American in the United States, you know, or anybody, because you're so discriminated against. But incredible drummer. He played, Clyde played on some of the Garbage records. He would just come in and play these loops. So one time, we were working on the first Garbage record, and he came in on a Saturday morning, like at 10 a.m., and unlike most musicians, Clyde would show up early. If I said, you know, I got there and go, shit, the kit sounds terrible. I got to get it tuned and I'm playing it. And he comes like a half hour early, goes, hey, brother, I'm here. And I'm thinking, going, oh my God, this is going to suck. The kit sounds so bad. He goes, oh, just let me go in and mess up. The second he started playing, it was incredible. And yeah. I'd been playing on it like 5 minutes before and it sounded like shit. So that just goes to tell you, sometimes it's the dynamics and what you're playing and how you play it. And he was just a true gentleman, true gentleman.
Eric Clapton, I think, and George Harrison. George Harrison bought a guitar from, I think, Guitar Center, one of those places. And he took the guitar around to George, and it was like, you know, Eric Clapton's favorite guitar for whatever that would be. And George is playing it, and he goes, yeah, but it doesn't sound like Eric. It doesn't sound like Eric. Why is there something wrong with it? And he was thinking to himself, well, yes, that's because you're not Eric Clapton. But, you know, whatever.
I remember having this theory of that, you know, instruments kind of embodied the person playing them, that Hendrix's guitar, you know, the kind of grain in the wood would sort of resonate in a peculiar way because of the feedback he was using, that he made a Strat sound different because of the way he bent the thing, you know, and powered it. I don't know. I came across Clyde Stubblefield quite late. I got this gig in Berlin as a college lecturer, as a, you know, a drum professor, which of course I'm not really. And the students all knew about.
Oh yes, Clyde. You are. Oh yes, you are. You are the drum professor.
Oh, I am now. It's official now. You know, it's on the website. But so I'm looking at a lot of videos of Clyde that I'd never seen this guy play, and it was just, you know, like that beat, and he's just going. And then they were talking about these grace notes, and he said ghost notes, and he said I never had any ghost notes. I just play the way I play, and I kind of thought he seems to, as you say, came across as a gentleman and somebody really relaxed behind the drums. Just, it's like second nature, as if he's always been there. Yeah.
Totally. I did the same thing. I asked him after one of the sessions, I asked him, Budgie, after one of the sessions, Clyde, how do you play like that? And he just looked at me and said, I try not to think about it. And I think that's it. It just, it came out of him, man, that kind of crazy, loose, perfect feel, and it's pretty magical.
Isn't it like the guys who played on the Motown records? You know, the story goes they shifted the office furniture out of the way, like set up the kit quickly, put the mics up, and all this kind of bap 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 bap, and you think every time you try and do it, you try and do it with that kind of feel, but you know there's something. It's a bit like you get the chance to play your favorite drum riff, and everybody does it. You know, you think this is, I really like doing this beat. And if you get the chance to play in a band, you sound like the best drummer in the world because you just know how to do this thing. And I think, is that like a lucky break you get when
I think it is. Well, you guys know how much luck sometimes and mistakes and happy accidents happen in the studio. You have to know when it's a good mistake and when it's a bad mistake. I think that's the trick of making good records, right?
I was wondering what you know, like, because every so often when you're in a band you have to check into a hotel under a different name, otherwise, you know, people are ringing you at 4 a.m. going, I love your music, and you're like, I see. I was wondering what your name would be. I would try and make up different combinations. I thought Mr. Fig would be good.
I'll tell you, I can't tell you because my tour manager, Levi, will get mad at me. but I usually pick either, and it changes sometimes from tour to tour, but either famous drummers.
Right.
Who, you know, who could be going back, 40, 50 years. Or because I'm a big sports fan with my Wisconsin team, the Green Bay Packers.
Oh, Green Bay Packers.
Packer players like Ray Nitschke, you guys probably wouldn't know them, but and sometimes I'll check in somewhere, they go, Mr. Nitschke, and then someone will go, wait, Ray Nitschke? They'll know. And then I go, oh, I can't use that name. I got to come up with something more obscure.
Yeah.
I know that for a while, Dave Grohl used Artemis Pyle, who was the drummer in Lynyrd Skynyrd. That was his hotel name for many years. And hopefully, Dave, you've changed it. So I just didn't just give a giveaway there. But I think he's changed it since then.
Did he not get like loads of calls? Maybe he got loads of calls. I would be glad of calls to my hotel room at 3 or 4 in the morning, you know, because I never got to sleep. No, half the time it was my problem. My problem was like, I know, either I couldn't sleep because I just wasn't trying to. And then there was a time when, the tours where I was trying to get to sleep and just became an insomniac because I could never come down from the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I do have somewhere over there, like a box of photos that I would take from the hotel window at night, you know, intersections and traffic lights change.
That sounds like a coffee table book.
Yeah, there you go.
I think it's
that's a coffee table book, Budgie.
Working on that one.
Insomnia at 3 a.m. I just got done with I just finished a 7-week run with Garbage. And
how was that?
I've been home about 2 weeks. I finally acclimated. It was great. The shows were awesome. We did a co-headline with Noel Gallagher, and then the Canadian band Metric opened for us. It was a great...
High Flying Birds.
Yeah, it was a great combo. Everyone got along great. Big crowds. But I can't sleep at all. I can't sleep on the tour bus. And then, if you guys know, sometimes you drive 4 or 5 hours, you pull into a hotel at 4 or 5 a.m. Then you get in, you try to lay down, and you lay there and go, okay, go to sleep. And I'm just, after like 2 or 3 days, I'm completely frazzled, as most of us are. And I have a theory that when you tour, your IQ drops 20 points.
Yes.
It just, you get dumber. Because I think lack of sleep, like there's so many things I go, I'm going to do this on the tour. I'm going to read these books. I'm going to go to this museum. And I usually start to do that. And then you get so frazzed out after about 2 or 3 weeks that you just sort of veg out. You know, I'll turn on, sometimes I turn on the weather channel in my hotel room. And I'll just look at what the local weather is and sort of stare at the screen for a couple hours and hopefully fall asleep for a few minutes. So... But you guys know that as well as me. Touring is hard.
Yeah, but I'm going to put it down to, maybe a little bit of the aging process, But I know that now I'm like a gentleman that I toured with. I thought, he takes a nap. He takes a nap at a certain time, like 2 hours before the show. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But I could never stop it. I was always working right up until, the intro music started.
Yeah.
But now I remember on this most recent touring I did was with singer-songwriter John Grant and his band. We were all about a similar age, and me and Jakob and Peter, the Icelandic trio, bar me, we'd all head back to the bus because usually the bus was parked outside the venue because it was one of those bus tours, and we're the only ones who loved our bunk, get in the bunk, cup of tea, head down for about half an hour, an hour before the show. And then we feel great. And then you're ready for the gig.
Yeah, it makes a difference. I mean, I think, the real difference is when I was, 30, 40 years ago, you could sleep on top of the gear in the back of the transit and for a couple of hours in the afternoon, and then you were awake for the rest of the night. Now it's like, if there's not a nice bed and a shower at the end of this, there's going to be trouble, so.
We're okay. We're all, blokes together. How do the female members of our team get on with festival sites and stuff?
Well, Shirley is she's a road dog. I mean, she loves touring and she loves being on stage. I think she's a bit of a show-off exhibitionist, as lead singers sometimes need to be. You guys know that
they can be.
Surely not Shirley.
But she takes pretty good care of herself. Tries to eat healthy and we don't really we drink wine and we'll have a few cocktails and stuff, but we don't really smoke, or there's no drugs or anything, so we're at this point we're trying to keep a fairly healthy life and eat, like I said, eating healthy I think is one of the things that is not always easy to do. Sometimes the catering is terrible and you're stuck somewhere where you can't find any good food, but It is what it is.
It makes up for the lack of sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
Take us back, Butch, to the beginning of Garbage. I got the brief story of it. I knew both Lol and I knew of Shirley in Goodbye, Mr. McKenzie,
right?
You know, and if it was, I always imagined Goodbye, Mr. McKenzie as like a kind of Scottish version of the band I was in Liverpool called Big in Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
Where there was all, you know, it was like everybody was destined for something, and Shirley was definitely destined. But how did it happen? It's a just a story I'm just intrigued by.
Well, we're very lucky. You know, Duke and Steve and I had started doing remixes for like House of Pain and Depeche Mode and U2 and Nine Inch Nails, and that sort of template of taking a track and then creating guitar and drum loops and weird noise loops and then putting the lead vocal of that back into it. That was what sort of got us excited about starting a band that sort of used that approach. And so we started writing some music, and we didn't really know who we wanted, but we thought it'd be great to work with a female singer. And there was a show on MTV called 120 Minutes that was on Sunday nights. You guys probably remember, they played a lot of cool alternative rock.
Yeah.
And Steve, the guitarist in Garbage, he had a VCR and he would tape it on video cassette. And he came in on one Monday morning and said, I saw this band called Angelfish. And the singer, Shirley, was great. And it was their single, I think the only single they released over here, called Suffocate Me. And what we loved about that song is that Shirley sang really low, like, suffocate me with your own desire, suffocate me. Compared to a lot of the alt singers of the time, there's a lot of sort of screaming, like heavy emotion, a lot of really pushing at him.
Right.
She sang the opposite. And so we called her up. This is a true story. We called her up, and she was doing dishes in her kitchen. And I think she thought it was bullshit. Yeah. Like, hey, we want to come over and meet you and talk. And like, would you be interested in coming over and singing some songs and see if there's some chemistry and whatever? So Duke and Steve and I flew to London, and we met her at some posh hotel. We weren't staying at this hotel, but Shirley was freaked out. It was like a really expensive hotel where it cost, you know, just to have some tea and stuff was like several hundred pounds for the afternoon. But we hit it off. We talked not even so much about music, but about politics and film and food and just things that we liked and disliked. And so we hit it off. I left to go to a restaurant to meet Flood and Alan Mulder and a bunch of other engineers and producers, because I really hadn't seen them. And I wanted to sit down and have a beer and talk. And I got there, and they were all staring at me. And I said, what's up? And they go, did you hear? Kurt Cobain is dead. And he committed suicide that same day that I met Shirley. And wow. It's very strange, because obviously Nirvana was had a huge impact on my life. It allowed me to sort of pick and choose what I wanted to work on as a producer. But that's the day I met Shirley. So it's literally a changing of the guard. My path just went in a different path that day. But anyway, Shirley came to our studio in Madison, Wisconsin, like 2 or 3 weeks later. And when we worked on some songs, it took a couple tries to sort of get the chemistry, but then, we've been doing it now for, well, so that was 1995. So, God, 28 years or something like that we've been a band.
Wow. And you're getting better now, right?
I don't know if we're getting better, but I think we've figured out a way that we kind of know how to keep it smooth. That's what our motto is. We're still challenging ourselves. We're working on a new record now, and I have to say some of the music is quite, at least for us, it's quite eclectic. Early on, who knows, by the time we finish the record early next year, it usually morphs into something, a different kind of beast. But we get along great. I mean, we enjoy each other's company. We had a blast on this tour. We very much take the piss out of each other. we make fun of each other, which I think is a healthy attitude. Don't take yourself too seriously.
Right. Actually, Shirley said some things to us about that, how that the good thing with your band was that because it's a very unnatural situation in lots of ways to be together as adults 24/7 with the people that you work with and the people that you hang out with, and people like, it's closer than being married in lots of ways for periods of time.
Yeah.
And she said one thing that you guys did that she, you know, which makes perfect sense to me and Budgie, is that when it started to get a little angst and a little, you know, difficult, you made a decision like, hey, let's just, we like each other. We always will like each other. So let's just hold it for a moment or two and come back when things feel better. And, you know, I look at my own history. I think there are definitely times when that would have been a really, really good idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
We wished we'd have heard that from somebody sooner, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, you never know what's going to go on. But I think, you know, definitely with me and Budgie, like, we're a slightly older gentleman now, we can avoid most of that kind of, you know, terrible teenage angst that goes on, you know, in bands up until your mid-30s, really, you know.
So. I get angst just doing this.
You know this, when we started out making records, it was the cycle. You would make a record, spend however long, 3 months or 6 months or a year or whatever, and then you would go on tour and promote it. And when you finished, you just did it again. And we did four records like that, and that's why we were just burnt out. So when we decided to take a break, I think all of us thought it would be about 18 months or so, or 2 years. It turned into 7 years.
Wow. The 7 year itch.
And then, we felt ready to go after a 7 year break, and we're making our eighth record as I speak now. So it's been great ever since we took that hiatus, as we call it.
Yeah, you're right. It's the nature of the beast. I mean, I think the first 5 years I had, it was like we made four albums and toured every album for 9 months a year. I mean, we were basket cases by year five, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes sense.
It's interesting now. I mean, I know a lot of young musicians, and it's the cycle. It's not really the same cycle anymore. Part of that's that so many people just consume singles, that they release a track or two, and then they'll go out and do some promotion, which usually doesn't last that long, and then they may go in and do maybe an album or whatever. But just with the internet and the way you can promote and market music now, it's everything has changed so much. So I don't think people get sucked into the kind of cycle that we were used to. You know, we started out. Well,
me and Budgie are going to bring that back, aren't we? We're going to bring it back. We're going to go for a solid 18 months on the road.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Yes, we're going to be nonstop for the next 3 years, right, Locke? Because we can't think of anything else to do.
Right.
Well, no, I can actually think of a lot of things I should be doing, but it's hard fitting things in. I never had a family when I was, like, you know, younger, and other commitments outside of the band. When Susie and the Banshees took a break, you know, Susie and I raised the Creatures to fill the gap.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
It was like, we couldn't stop.
Yeah, well, I don't think that we understood how sort of burnt out we were until we were like at least a couple years into taking that time off. Cause then we, like Shirley said, we started hanging out. We'd go out to dinner, or we'd, you know, go to a party somewhere. We'd hang out. And we realized how much we still love each other. And really that's the reason that we're still able to work together as a band. As a producer, I've worked with many bands that they won't even talk to each other in the room. You go in and you have to talk to the guitarist and talk to the drummer or the singer, and you try to get him sort of focused, and then it can be very difficult sometimes, and a lot of bands obviously don't last that long because of that dynamic. It's like you said,
it's kind of amazing to me, because, you know, in many ways, you know, when I look at The Cure, despite, you know, things that went on and that, it was really started off that way as a gang, you know, like a gang of friends, and that was that's what its strength was. And, you know, we have, me and Budgie have made a record now, and with our producer, Jack Knife Lee.
Right on.
He was telling me the other day that that very same thing, you know, he works with lots of bands that people, you know, oh, the guitarist hates the singer, the singer hates the drummer, you know. It's just, honestly, why the fuck would you do it? You know, really, you know, life is too short. Find a bunch of people you like.
I thought that was normal. I thought that was the way it should be. The friction, the creative friction that kind of crept in. And there'd be moments of levity where it was all going great. And then there'd be those moments where really it was like everybody in their own corner, you know, and there's like, where's the referee?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between healthy creative friction, you know, like you look at, you know, it's that film that was out, you know, the old resurfaced Beatles stuff, and you see, like, you know, Lennon and McCartney sort of, you know, going backwards and forwards, and then you see George Harrison looking like a sort of evil spirit in the corner, you know. It's like, and Ringo,
we know what Ringo was doing, don't we?
Yeah
we all know what Ringo was sitting there going like, these guys, one day they'll sort it out.
I felt terrible for Ringo because, you know, there are these long shots and they're just going back and forth. And Ringo just had to sit there and wait until they started playing. Okay, now I'll come in, and then wait while they're noodling around.
He probably had a book on top of the kick drum. You know, he's probably reading that way. So like, oh, ready?
Yeah.
I saw him at the Greek here. First time, like, you know, my wife who goes to all the concerts, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got tickets for Ringo, and I go, oh, sick, Paul McCartney, I've never seen Ringo. So I'm going to go and see Ringo. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Two things from it. One, Ringo plays the whole set, sings, plays.
Wow, right on.
And then at the end of the set, he's doing jumping jacks on stage. He's 82 years old, for goodness sake. I mean, you know, he's like, I just do this because it's fun. And that's great. And then the other thing is, he gets all his mates. So he had Edgar Winter on there. And I would like, when I die, if I go to heaven, I want God to look like Edgar Winter, because he was
yeah, man,
amazing. You know, it's like all my 14-year-old dreams coming back, watching the old Grey Whistle Test and seeing him play. He plays everything, you know. It's just like,
yeah, yeah. And I think, was Joe Walsh on the tour? Or
not on this tour. Instead, they had the guy from, I'm going to get mail for this, the guy from Toto playing guitar, whose name I don't remember, but yeah.
Oh, Steve Lukather,
yes,
maybe?
Yes, it might have been him.
Whatever. Anyway, Ringo, if Ringo calls and say, hey, you want to go out with my band? You say, yes, I do. So he's always going to be playing with killer musicians. And why wouldn't that be a blast, you know?
Yeah, I mean, everybody was very good, and everybody played, you know, their hits. So there was the guy from the Average White Band, or the guy from Men at Work. Both people, I don't know their names.
Cool. That's so cool.
No, it was good. It was very entertaining. The only bad thing about it was, you know, because me and my wife, Cindy, we were the youngest people there. The only bad thing about it was, at the end, the lines for the bathrooms were phenomenal, because, you know, all these 75-year-old people have been, you know, jigging it up, drinking lots of beer and stuff.
I thought the lines would have been non-stop, lol, all evening. Nobody could hold it. One song, that's it, gotta go.
This whole thing, you know, because the set was, we played about 75 minutes on this tour, a little bit longer, because we flip with Noel. Some shows we played the last slot, and some shows we played the middle slot. But I have this whole thing that my wife is sort of amused by. But I get up and I front load my day with like 2 big liters of water, and I put this hydrating thing in it, so I get electrolytes and stuff, and then I sort of, you know, I have coffee and I eat a lunch around 1 or 2, and then I don't like to eat or drink much before we go on, so
right.
And I stop drinking fluids about 3 or 4 p.m. and then I time it, so if we're going on say at 8:30, I take a pee like at 8:25,
right.
And then I don't have to pee, because I haven't had, you know, I haven't been drinking pints of lager for the last, like when I was stupid, like 20 years ago, I would do that. Mm-hmm. And then I go on halfway through the set, holy shit, I have to take a really bad pee. And so, cause there's nothing worse than playing drums and having to go to the bathroom, you know? So and then of course, when you're done, all bets off, you can have whatever you want to eat and drink.
Right.
But it's a weird thing. And my wife is always amused. Like, that's so weird. You do that. No, it's not.
No, it's not weird at all. I do exactly the same thing nowadays. And the last tour I did it, me and Jason, the Cure's current drummer, would come off and just, you know, drink up and carb up afterwards because, you know, you don't want to do anything beforehand.
Yeah.
Back in the day, though, when we were like first in the queue, we had these big screens at the side of the stage. And of course, because I was drinking, you know, and, you know, not doing, you know, it was five, I was drinking on stage, off stage all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Crew would put a bucket behind the screen and there was a long entrance to one song, I think at Grinding Halt. And I would just sort of run off and Robert would keep going with a little bit of guitar and I'd have to speak. And it worked out fine until the day that the LD decided to bring the floor lamps up on the back and there was this like 50-foot shadow of me peeing into a bucket, you know, and titters from the audience. And it, the only thing I could do is come on back on stage and pretend like nothing happened at all. Just go, yeah, what?
Wait, that wasn't me. That was somebody else.
That's somebody else in the crew. Yeah.
I love that.
There are no photographs of this, lol. There is no footage.
No, thank God.
Yeah, that was before the internet, so you're lucky you got away with that one, right?
Yeah, oh my God, are we so lucky before the internet? I mean, I look back at some of the Polaroids I've got of things, and I'm like, I am so glad this has not been seen by anybody.
I concur.
The best pee break I saw, and I've only seen one really, our dear departed, the legend of Ginger Baker. And Ginger was Shepherd's Bush Empire, and he had on stage with him Jack Bruce. And Zildjian were hosting this kind of show. It was a kind of anniversary, and Ginger was talking about his cymbals and how he'd had the same set,
right,
the first cymbal Zildjian gave him. And they were playing away, and then they were going through a few Cream songs. They had a good guitarist on. Clapton came up behind on a screen, you know, beamed in from LA. And halfway through, and then suddenly everything stopped, and Ginger just kind of got up, you know, and he just walked off, which is interesting because I don't think Jack had really figured on this. So Jack's kind of, you know, dressed in finery and velvet and stuff, and looks up at the audience and goes like, raises his arms and goes, I have no idea. Where's he gone? But as Ginger walks off, he's got a bicycle clip round his trouser legs, you know, to keep the trousers from flapping, or a sock over the hi-hat leg, you know. That I'd like, I thought, wow, this is trade secret stuff. Anyway, Ginger comes back after a suitable time, and then he does that thing you may remember from when you were first on stage, and as a drummer, you've got no way of communicating with anybody except through the snare drum mic, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So you bend down into your snare bike, and he went, call of nature, gotta be, call of nature, gotta go. He says, thank you very much, everybody. We can continue with the show now.
I love that.
And Jack's going like, love it.
I thought you were going to say that, you know, he had one of those bag things strapped to his leg, and the reason for the clip was to stop it.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Yeah,
he was going to sort of unfurl it and let it out.
Yeah, go empty it. Let me go empty my bag and my leg here. That documentary on Ginger Baker was amazing. I mean, I had no idea he was so, what's the right word, volatile. You know, you wanted to steer a clear path if he was in a bad mood. But some of the footage of him playing like jazz drums was unbelievable. I only knew him really from Cream and the rock bands that he played with. And he was a badass drummer, man.
No, he was a very badass drummer. As a person, I mean, I think that movie painted him in one particular, maybe he wasn't completely like that. Maybe he was, you know. But I like the beginning of that one where he goes, bang, and hits the guy and says, just come and talk to me. I'm not going to do anything to you. I'm not going to hit you unless you say, just come and say it to me.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can see that the journalist backing up slowly, like, okay, I'm fine. I'm fine with about a 12-foot space between us here.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I must have seen Ginger Baker at the time. He must have been doing the photo shoot for his autobiography. And you know, what was it called? What was it called? I can't think what it was called.
Oh, it had a big angel on the front. It had a picture of him standing with angel wings.
It was him in his leather coat, floor length leather coat with white angel wings on the back. It was called something like Dangerous or something.
Dirty Angel or something. I can't remember what it was called.
And I was sitting with the drummer from AC/DC, not the original guy. It was the guy who invented, I think he had like a shaved head, bald head, big guy, lovely man. He's waiting for AC/DC for weeks. And we're sitting at the bar, being polite, being nice, being kind of drummers at the bar. And the lift doors opened and people turned. So we all turned and it was Ginger with a lady on each arm with this long full-length black leather coat on. You know, it was just the look of, yes, I know. I know. Wouldn't you like to be me?
It is me.
I'm Ginger Baker.
Ginger Baker.
That is great.
Be prepared.
Somebody told me a similar kind of story like that with Charlie Watts. You know, this French lady. She told me he came in and he looked like the king.
It was Chris Slade. I just remembered Chris. Sorry about that.
Oh yeah. Speaking of drummers, I just heard, and Charlie Watts, a friend of mine, our publisher, BMG, I think there's a new Stones record coming out because I just heard a couple rough mixes. I don't know how under the radar it is, but I think they've done a whole new record. Obviously, Charlie, I think they have a couple tracks that Charlie had played, recorded a couple years, you know, before he passed away. I'm not even sure who's drumming on the rest of the tracks, but the two tracks I heard sounded great, and I gotta say Jagger sounds amazing as a singer. I mean, he's going for it in these songs. He does not sound as old as he is, you know. When I started playing drums, I wanted to be Keith Moon, and I realized very quickly I am not Keith Moon, but I could play more like Ringo and Charlie Watts. And so those are the records that I put on, like Stones records and Beatles records with headphones. I'd play along and try to figure out those beats, and I you know, it makes me think I want to go see Ringo play sometime. I've never seen him perform, and I never got to see the Stones either. I never saw Charlie play, you know.
It's really good. I mean, I realized looking at old movies and stuff that, you know, I learned the hi-hat from Charlie Watts because I played the same. But he used to live near me. I used to live in the deepest countryside in England, in Devon, and he used to live near me, and I heard lots about it, but I never met him until one day I was taking a train to London, and I got off in Paddington Station, and I'm just walking along the train platform, and I see this elderly gentleman in front of me with like, you know, something wasn't quite right, because from the back he looked like a doctor with this, you know, doctor's bag and stuff, but The jacket was far too flamboyant for an old guy, you know, in the jacket. I thought, who is that wearing that thing? And I pulled up beside him and it's like Charlie Watts. Like, oh, hi, Charlie, you know, we're neighbors, blah, blah, blah. And that is very nice.
Cool. Right on.
Cool guy. Curious Creatures is presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio design, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Associate producer and digital marketing, Marge Taylor.
Visual designer, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jack Knife Lee.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2024.